Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is editorial director for Sweetwater, Mitch Gallagher. But first of all, I bet you didn't know, but Spotify actually does play music videos. And that's the source of some sort of tension between the publishers, record labels, and Spotify. There's actually a lot of tension these days between Spotify and the record labels. And a lot of that comes from the fact that Spotify has tried to do direct deals with both artists and indie labels. That would mean that the major labels are being cut out, so they're not too happy about that. Of course, what's going to happen relatively soon is the fact that what we're going to see is a renegotiation of the terms of the licensing agreements that they have. So that means that up until then, there's a lot of tension until they actually get that out of the way. But when it comes to music videos, one of the big problems is the fact that Spotify is not actually paying the music publishers. One of the reasons why is Spotify has a tendency to experiment with features, and they roll them out before they tell anybody, and then they go back later and they try to get permission to do so and work out a licensing scheme, and they haven't really done it in the case of music videos. So everybody's a little testy because of this, because let's face it, that means the publishers and songwriters are not getting paid from Spotify music videos. Now, even though they don't make up a great number of the activity on Spotify, music videos are important, and they're especially important to some playlists, especially the big ones. Rap Caviar is a big one where music videos really do make a big impact on it. So, in fact, this is something that everybody is worried about, wondering about, and wondering how it's going to make an impact on the next round of contract talks that should be happening relatively soon. So, if you haven't watched any videos on Spotify, go check them out, just like watching them anywhere else, but it's a little bit more convenient, I think, than it is on YouTube, especially when you're trying to find something new. So anyway, Spotify videos and the war around them. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Just a heads up that my new book, The Music Business Advice Book, is now available and was the number one seller on the Amazon Music Business Books chart. It's comprised of 150 immediately useful tips compiled from the interviews from this podcast. You'll find it on Amazon and most other online book retailers, as well as a bookstore near you. And again, thank you all for your support. Now, I bet you didn't know, but Neumann microphones actually carry a number of different colored logo badges. In other words, right on the front, you'll find a logo. But guess what? There are actually five different colors, and they all mean something. So I'm going to pull back the curtain on this Neumann mystery. So first of all, we have red, black, purple, blue, and green. Those are the five colors. All this information comes from Pro Tools Expert, by the way. Thank you very much. It's a great online resource. And they have a version for just about every different digital audio workstation out there, not just Pro Tools. So, first of all, red. A red Neumann logo means it's a transformerless transistor microphone. Red means transformerless transistor mic. A black badge, however, indicates that it's a tube microphone. A purple badge means it's a transistor mic, only it has a transformer. So red and purple are different, one with the transformer, one without. A blue logo badge means it's a digital microphone. I think they only have one or two in the line. And a green badge means it's a dynamic microphone. Of course, Neumann isn't known for those so much, but nonetheless, if it's a Neumann product, you know it's made well. So there we have it. Green, red, black, purple, and blue, the color of the Neumann badges. My guest this week is Sweetwater's editorial director, Mitch Gallagher, who started his career as a guitarist, vocalist for various rock and country bands while earning a degree in music from Morehead State University and studying with various classical guitar masters. After making his living as a touring musician, he made a left turn into the music magazine business, first as a technical editor for Keyboard Magazine, and then as the editor-in-chief for EQ Magazine. Along the way, Mitch has published thousands of articles for a wide variety of industry magazines, as well as 8 books. But you may know him today for his excellent work on the Sweetwater's 3 weekly video shows, Sweetwater Minute, Guitars and Gear, and the iOS Update. During this interview, we spoke about what it's like to have access to the latest and greatest music and audio products, the latest trends in gear, and the secret advice that he received that enabled him to finally release his latest EP called Foundation. We spoke via Skype from his home studio in Fort Wayne, Indiana. How did you get into the business, and then how did you transition into writing and being an editor?
Very good questions. I come from a small town in North Dakota, and I was one of very few guitar players there, so I moved to Fargo, North Dakota, and went to college. And I met some musicians and went on the road and did the rock cover band thing for about a year, and then I did the hotel lounge cover band thing for about a year, year and a half, country, you know, the country circuit, all over the Midwest, up into Canada, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Nebraska, you know, Iowa, all over that area we played. And decided to go back to school. While I was in school, I started working at a music store teaching guitar lessons. And so I did that for the duration of the rest of my college career. Moved to Kansas City to attend the University of Missouri, Kansas City, studying music composition and electronic music. I'm sorry, music composition and classical guitar is what I was studying there, focusing mainly on electronic music. And started working at a music store there called Big Dudes Music City. And while I was there, I started to write a few articles for little guitar newsletters, taught some classes for the other, for some of the other salespeople, but also for the public. On the weekends, I'd go in and teach classes. And so I kind of got into that whole educational side of it and started writing up some materials for all those things. And that was kind of the start of me getting into to really doing any writing at all. I'd never done any writing before that. But I was always kind of the gear guy in the band, you know, the guy who could get the mixer working, get the PA set up. You know,
me too. Yeah.
I was the first guy that did the you know, kind of figured out the 4-track cassette so we could make a demo and, you know, the usual story, right?
Yeah.
4-track cassette. Boy, I'm dating myself there. But while I was in Kansas City, I was also playing in bands, and I had built a studio in my house and was doing some albums for people. I did a lot of parody recordings for local radio stations where they'd say, hey, we need this Duke Ellington song so we can put different lyrics on it. And so I'd do all the backing tracks for that. Wow. And so I did that and did, you know, man, I did Duke Ellington. I did Heart. I mean, everybody who was big in the 80s, I was doing parody tracks for them for these radio stations, which was an amazing education. Just tuned your ear like you wouldn't believe, both musically and also as an engineer, because you're trying to duplicate the sounds and get the, you know, the exact same thing going. And so I was going to grad school. I was working at the music store. I was playing in bands, had the studio at home, was doing the whole thing. And quite honestly, I was, you know, out of hours in the day that were, and so I needed a break. I was just ready for a break. And I saw this ad in the back of Mix Magazine for this store I had never heard of called Sweetwater. And so I applied. That was in 1992, and I was hired as the 5th sales engineer. And my employee number is number 30, and you know, they're probably at like 5,000 now or something. So I wasn't in the very earliest building, which was basically in Chuck's house, but I was in the first dedicated building they had for Sweetwater, which was just a little metal building in a gravel parking lot in the middle of a cornfield. It was literally what it was. And so they brought me out and I did the interview. And even then, it was very clear that Chuck just had a different idea, a different approach to doing things. And the rest of the guys were all just, they were so expert. And so, you know, the whole approach to customer service was already in place. The whole approach of tech support and expertise on the phones and all that stuff was already there. So I came out here. I moved to Fort Wayne. It was actually October 30th of 1992 is when I started here. And I was here for about 5.5 years. Now, after a couple of years, I actually transitioned out of sales and into the marketing department. And I wrote the first catalogs and started the blog, the InSync Daily blog, which is still going today. I started the Word for the Day. I started the Tech Tip for the Day. I did thousands of those things, literally. And so I was doing a ton of writing. and writing articles for Sweet Notes and the different publications that they had at that time. It was before the, you know, video or any of those kind of things. And, you know, after 5.5 years or whatever, it was 1998. I just saw a little ad in the back of Keyboard magazine. You know, we're looking for editorial. I think they were looking for an editorial assistant is what they were looking for. And so I applied, not even really knowing what an editorial assistant was. And they said, well, you're way overqualified to be editorial assistant, but what we really need is a technical editor. And so I ended up becoming the technical editor at Keyboard Magazine and later became the senior technical editor there. So I moved out to San Francisco and was the technical editor at Keyboard Magazine, which was really interesting for a guitar player to be the technical editor at Keyboard. But I was always the MIDI guy, you know, I was always the technology guy. And so I understood all the samplers and all the keyboards of the day, and I was really big on software and things, and so it was a perfect fit for me. I just loved doing that gig, and the crew was just amazing. The staff they had at that time was, you know, it was still the golden age of those magazines, and it was really, really cool. It was, for me, that was a dream come true, because I remember reading Keyboard Magazine back before I even played instruments. I was buying Keyboard and I was buying Guitar Player, and those two magazines were like my Bible, right?
Yeah.
And so to get to go there and work with those guys. And the Guitar Player guys were in the same building just down the hall, and Bass Player was there, and you know, and a couple other magazines. And so that was just like a dream come true. And I remember going to my first NAMM show on the editorial journalist side, and I sat down in my very first meeting, and Craig Anderton sat down next to me. And Craig was like my hero, right? I wanted to be Craig Anderton.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he sat down and I introduced myself, you know, all nervous, and he's like, oh, you're the guy that's going to be editing my articles. Like, oh, crap. And of course, we've become best friends and we still work together to this day. And Craig is incredible. He's just an amazing guy, but scared the crap out of me, basically.
Yeah. I could just imagine him doing that too. I would just imagine how he'd say it, that it would come across like that. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was my introduction to the whole thing. I'd literally been at Keyboard Magazine like a week. At that point. But so fast forward 2 years, I'm senior technical editor at Keyboard, and I get a phone call from the New York office of the company that owns Keyboard, and they say, we are looking for an editor for EQ Magazine. And EQ Magazine kind of had a virtual staff up to that point. There were people who worked on it, but there really wasn't a dedicated editor for the magazine. They were kind of doing, a group was kind of doing all that stuff, which worked great, and there were great magazines. I had subscribed to it from day one. I loved it.
Yeah.
And so I jumped at the chance and went out there and interviewed and ended up getting the gig in 2000 as editor of EQ, which I think is about when we met, probably the first trade show after that. And then you wrote however many, probably hundreds of articles for me through the years there. Yeah, I was there for 5.5 years until mid 2005. And as you know, at that point, a lot of the magazines, I mean, the landscape changed pretty dramatically, you know, and as the editor, I was having to deal with a lot of that kind of, let's just say, the corporate aspects of the music, of the magazine industry. And to be honest with you, it just wasn't as much fun anymore.
Sure.
And so I had stayed on really good terms with Chuck, the owner of Sweetwater, and I always saw him at trade shows, and I'd left on very good terms. And so I called him up, and he's like, well, come and do what you're doing for the magazines, but do it for me, because I need somebody to do all these publications and to kind of oversee everything. And so I came back here, middle of 2005, March 2005, actually, is what it was. And at that time, I was overseeing the Pro Gear catalog, the Sweet Notes publication, which is our newsletter. It goes out, at that time, it went out every other month. The web, all the web text and everything. So I was busy just doing tons of stuff. And then, which I loved. I just absolutely loved it. It's just, I mean, totally in my wheelhouse to work on articles and to play with new gear and to try things out and be involved in that, all those aspects of it is so cool. But what has really been fun is in 2009, we decided we should try doing some videos. And so we literally were in my office with a handheld, you know, just a handheld camera. And we're like, okay, Mitch, show us what new gear has showed up on your desk. And I, you know, they're terrible. I look at them now and I just cringe. I can hardly watch them, you know. But it worked, and it was we got a lot of great hits and a lot of great attention and a lot of positive comments. And so we started building the video department. And since then, I've done probably, I haven't added them up, but if I just look at averages for a year, somewhere around probably 1,600 videos for Sweetwater.
Wow.
And those are everything from product demos to how-to videos to lots and lots of artist interviews, engineer-producer interviews, tons of trade show coverage. I have three shows a week that I do that are kind of scheduled, and then lots of other things that show up. But there are now six of us who do videos here at Sweetwater, counting myself. And then there's a staff of 6 or 7 production people who are shooting the videos and editing them. And so, you know, we have two studios that we shoot out of here. We have a big studio where we can do larger shoots and drum kits and bigger artist interviews and things. And then I have what I call my insert studio, which is basically set up like a pro audio recording studio. And that's where I do a lot of the microphone demos and software demos and those kind of things. And so we have those two spaces that we can work work between with all the different people shooting here. So, I mean, I've just landed in my dream gig. I mean, it's so fun. You know, I get to meet all these incredible people. I get to see all this incredible gear, usually well ahead of everybody else. And I get to talk about it and play with it and show it and demonstrate it. And I just have a blast.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that. But first, I didn't realize that you were such an early employee at Sweetwater. I thought that Sweetwater came after your magazine stint, but it's in the middle, basically.
I'm a boomerang.
Yeah. Let me tell you my Chuck story.
Yeah.
Because I have an early Chuck story, too. I was the sales manager for AMEC consoles way back when, the U.S. sales manager.
And you had one in when I first came here.
And I had a rep that said, you just have to come meet this guy. You have to meet Chuck. And he wants to be a dealer. And I'm thinking, a dealer for our consoles, a pretty high end. He's in Fort Wayne. How's that going to work? So I come out and I meet Chuck, and all Chuck had was a small music store. Sweetwater was in that strip mall originally. It might be before your time, but
I don't remember it ever being in a strip mall. So that was, well before my time.
Yeah. So it was in a strip mall. And it's a small store, too. It wasn't even large. And we get to talking, and he starts to lay out his grand vision. And the grand vision was mail order and everything. And I'm thinking to myself, the politics of this is going to be incredible, because at the time, there's so many dealers out there, and they'd all go crazy when there'd be somebody doing any kind of mail order. I said, Chuck, I just don't see how you're going to do that. And here we are, 30 years later, and not only did he pull it off, but he pulled it off really well. Granted, Guitar Center helped him out when he came in and they killed all the local dealers off. That helped. And then the internet, of course. And then people like you that are taking it to another level. Because when I look at what you do, I look at it and I think, and this happens, Mitch, so often. I look and I think, this is the modern magazine. This is what magazines should be doing. Because that's what you're doing. You're putting together a magazine, only it's virtual.
Right.
You do it so well. It's great. I must admit, every time you put something out, I look at it and I think, wow, this is just awesome. This is the way it ought to be.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that very much. Yeah. The story goes that, Chuck had a K250, which was the early Kurzweil, you know, the first, one of the first sampling keyboards.
Yeah.
And at the time it was kind of a closed system. It was very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how much money it was, $20,000 or $30,000 or something in those days. And he reverse engineered it and made a sound block for it. And so he started getting calls from people like Stevie Wonder and Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton and their touring managers and their music directors saying, hey, help, you know, can we buy your sounds? And so he started this network to trade sounds and to do all this thing and to trade all that stuff that he was creating. And they started calling and saying, you know, we love the service you give us on this Kurzweil. Why can't we buy our Kurzweil gear from you? And so he became a Kurzweil dealer. And then they said, well, we buy that. Why can't we buy this from you? Why can't we? So he became a dealer for that. And so it was a very organic kind of way that he got into the business, all based on that, which still continues today, is really the common thread for the company, is based on that expertise and delivering something that nobody else could deliver. And so it really goes back to those early days of Chuck literally reverse engineering the Kurzweil K250 and these big stars, and then they told their friends and so on and so on and so on, and just grew by word of mouth into this whole kind of thing. And then, you know, it's just exploded from there. But it still basically works exactly the same kind of way. You know, people are looking for a solution, and we have the expertise. The idea is that we have the expertise to deliver that solution for them, whatever it might be.
I had no idea that he started like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's because he was a musician. He plays saxophone. He still plays 100 gigs a year, you know, 100 nights a year, whatever. He's got two bands that he's with. That he's very busy. And so he's a musician doing that and had a studio in his house and got into the whole Kurzweil thing kind of around the back door kind of approach to it, which is really a cool, great American success story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's talk about your gig there. What I find interesting is you must be inundated with gear. I mean, everybody and their brother wants their gear in Sweetwater. And of course, everybody wants your kind of, I'm not going to say it's a seal of approval, but they want your presentation of it. So that being said, how do you decide what you're going to showcase?
That's a great question. I forget, because I'm not directly involved kind of in that side of it, but there we have something like 30,000 items in our 30,000 SKUs, you know, and obviously multiples of those. So all of those products want coverage. They all want to be presented and be you know, put out there. And clearly we can't. And so there actually is, back in the day, it was a little bit more whoever came to me, you know, yeah. But it's got where we can't do that anymore. You know, with six of us and with so much going on and so many lines and so many products and things. So it really is much more of a group kind of a consensus on it at this point. I certainly weigh in with my opinion, but we have an incredible merchandising department. Those are the people who actually order the equipment and keep it in our warehouse and manage all that, which is an astounding job. And they do it I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they have the foresight to know how many to order and what to order and what's going to be popular and what's going to sell, but they do. And so all of us kind of get together and we'll say, you know, we think this product is going to need a push, or this product deserves a push, or we have this product coming in. We think it's really cool. A lot of times for me personally, I just think it's cool. Hmm. Why would I not? You know, that's kind of why would I spend my time on something I don't think is cool? And so generally that's a big part of it for all us content producers is it's cool.
Yeah.
So it's on our side of it. And then there's the side of it that comes from merchandising where they're looking at some of the more, you know, the more, data driven sides of things, but they also, a lot of it is just my gut. A lot of it is just, what are we interested in? What looks like it's really going to be cool.
Now, what's interesting is coming from the magazine side of the business, where obviously you hear about what's new all the time. You hear about what's going on and a few pieces come through for review and everything, but you get your hands on everything. There's all sorts of gear that's coming through there. And I would have to think that, no, there comes a point where you go, I don't know if I can keep up with all this.
That is, that was a problem, if you want to call it a problem. It's actually kind of cool if you think about it. But it's been even in the magazine industry, how do you keep ahead of all of the, not just products, but all the knowledge you need to have? Mm. I mean, it is a huge part of my job just staying current, whether that's with just the new technologies or the new approaches or what's happening with not just the technology, but also with music. So you're on top of the trends and how people are using things and what they're using and where they're using it and how they're using it. In the old days, Sweetwater was very much just recording and keyboards. By the time I left in 98, we were just barely getting into guitars. I think we had Paul Reed Smith guitars was the first brand we brought in. And so we had just gotten guitars. I don't think we had an amplifier line yet at that point. And there were no drums. There was no, you know, there was no EDM, there was no lighting, there was some live sound, but it was more focused and a little easier, but still a tremendous challenge to stay ahead of that. Now we do everything, you know, whether it's drums and guitars and basses and keyboards and computers and software and live sound and recording equipment and lighting and, you know, I mean, on and on and on. It's incredible. So part of what has made it possible is really my focus now is pro audio and higher tech guitar, as well as, you know, some of the modeling stuff, the digital guitar stuff, some of the pedals, some of the amps, and some of the guitars as well. But we now have someone on staff, Nick DiRigilio, amazing drummer.
Oh, I know Nick. Yep. Sure.
Nick Bocott is now here doing more of the metal guitar stuff. You know, Don Carr does a lot of the pedals and some of the amplifiers. He and I kind of split the guitar stuff. We have Daniel Fisher, who's sort of the ultimate mad scientist synthesizer expert guy. And we have Jacob Dupre is our newest guy, is a tremendous keyboard player. And so he's been doing digital pianos and keyboards and some of the software kind of things. And so we've been able to split it a little bit, but I still try to I still try to keep my fingers in all of it, so I know a little more. I like to just have an understanding of what everything is doing, because you just can't stay in a vacuum, right? If all I did was recording stuff, you'd miss out on how that's impacting and interacting with all the other aspects of it. So that's a super long-winded way of saying it's a tremendous challenge. It really is.
Okay, you're the perfect guy to ask then. What do you consider like the biggest trend in musical instruments, or pro audio for that matter? Is there something new that's coming up that maybe a lot of people don't know about?
Oh man, that's a great question. And believe me, I get asked that question all the time. You know, I think it would be interesting to compare what I think to what our sales trends show, and, you know, what's popular on the website and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, there are the staples. There are those things that are just, everybody wants them as the basis for what they're doing. Like in a recording studio, we have certain preamps, we have certain, you know, all those kind of things that are just the go-to items, right? The digital stuff has just made a tremendous inroad, and I see that continuing. I see the desktop production thing really getting getting better and better and better. I mean, it really is astounding what you can do with a little desktop studio. Having said that, I think there's a lot of interest. There's a surprising amount of interest in acoustical treatment and that kind of thing, because people realize the room is a big part of what makes a great recording.
Good. That's a good thing.
Yeah. That's a big deal. But, you know, the new digital stuff, I think the digital modeling microphones are pretty intriguing. You know, they're doing some amazing stuff. There's three of them out there now, and I think they're pretty astounding. And plugins continue to get better. You know, we see DSP improving. We see new approaches to stuff. You'd think after all these years, you'd get a little jaded, or, you know, you'd think you'd seen it all before, and then something shows up. Yeah. It just is like, wow, how the heck does that do that? I'll give you an example. The latest one that just came across my desk was, and I just did a video on it, was a plugin from Zenaptic. And I want to say Intensity is the name of it, but it's kind of a mastering plugin. It's kind of an EQ. It's kind of a compressor. It uses like facial recognition technology to do all this predictive and adaptive kind of process. And I have no clue what's going on under the hood, but it just sounds great. It works great. It's amazing. It's like, where did this come from? You know, who thought of this using facial recognition stuff? So, yeah. You know, even though we always, it's easy to say, oh, it's all been done or whatever, but it hasn't. There's still wide open for new stuff to come out.
One of the things I find interesting is the seeming takeover of amplifier modeling, where all of a sudden it's acceptable to go out almost anywhere and gig with a modeler. And now we're seeing large acts doing it. You see Metallica going out without amplifiers. You go, wow, okay, I guess this has really caught on then.
I think there are several reasons for that. Number one, they've gotten to where the tones are now acceptable for what guitar players are looking for. And above that, the feel has gotten acceptable, because that was always kind of those were the two aspects, right? Because it's one thing to sound like it if it doesn't feel right. Yep. So you got to have both of those. But maybe even more than that, especially for the bigger touring acts like you're talking about, I mean, we have a lot of artists come through here. It's a logistical thing. It's a heck of a lot easier to pick up your lunchbox size Kemper than it is to have stacks and stacks of Marshalls. And maybe you'd prefer the Marshalls just for a variety of reasons, but from a stick it in the overhead on the airplane kind of standpoint, it makes a lot of sense, right? And the other thing I think we're seeing is a real move toward, if not silent stages, really, really volume controlled stages. And that has so many benefits, both from a monitoring standpoint, whether you're using in-ears or you're using live monitors on stage, but it has just tremendous benefits for front of house, in that you're not fighting that stage volume that for so many years you kind of had to have because the PAs couldn't keep up. Now we've got PA systems that are, you know, awesome and incredible, and you don't need to have that stage volume. The only reason for the stage volume is for some reason, from a performance standpoint, need or want to have it. And so I think that has driven that, especially in the house of worship market. You know, very rarely do you go into church anymore where there's live amplifiers on stage. It's a silent stage. You know, the electronic drums and the whole thing is silent. Once you play that way and you don't go home with your ears ringing, and you know, you're even if you wore your plugs and your body beat up just from the sheer decibel level, you know, it can be kind of freeing. But you know, once you get into that kind of an approach to performing, and again, just to go beyond that, the sound is the same absolutely every night. You know, it doesn't change because you're going direct with a digital product, whether it's into your ears and into the front of house or whatever. There's so many variables that are removed. So I think those are all the reasons why we're seeing an increase in interest in that. Having said that, you know, I don't think there's any danger or any even trend at all for real amplifiers, for lack of a better way to say it, going away. Mm. Because real amplifiers are still, you know, just as popular as they've always been and just used just as much. It's just another tool is the way that I see it, whether in the studio or on the stage.
Yeah. Have you seen a trend in pro audio?
I have. It's interesting. In the last couple of months, I've interviewed several artists and talked to a number of artists that are really getting back to wanting to record live in the studio. In fact, one of the last artists I just interviewed, Corey Wong, plays with a band called Wolfpack. They don't even wear headphones. You know, so these are younger musicians going into the studio and recording the way it was done, you know, back in the day. And I don't think they're doing that for technical reasons. They're doing it for musical reasons. And that's driving, you know, some of the things that are happening in pro audio, because obviously you have to have a setup that will allow you to track in that kind of a situation. And above all that, you got to have a room to do it in, if you're really going to capture it well. But that's an interesting trend to me, is that I see bands getting back to live recording as opposed to overdubbing, you know, and doing everything part by part by part. Interesting trend.
I love that. And you can always predict that it was going to happen, because everything goes in cycles. And we had gone so far the other way that you'd think, well, sooner or later, it has to pull back to recording the way we were used to doing it once upon a time. And we found to be very effective.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I should have asked this question, and I kind of wish I had asked the question, because I'm curious what is driving these artists to do that. And my suspicion is that, you know, when I talk to my younger nephews and nieces, and they're listening to classic rock, and they're listening to, you know, have you heard this amazing band Aerosmith from the 70s, you know, or Boston or Van Halen or whomever, you know, and I suspect that bands are listening to that music and hearing something that they're not hearing with the part by part by part approach. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, because obviously we get great music out of both approaches, but it's a little bit more organic approach that I think on the musician side of it, filtering over to the studio pro audio side of it, is appealing.
Oh yeah. Oh, definitely. And one can only hope that continues, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
It stays organic. Let's talk about your EP.
Yeah.
It took you a long time to get this out, right? You don't put one out every year.
No, you're not the first person to recognize that fact. I had a friend of mine who I met actually when I was in Kansas City, and he said, you know, if I had saved a quarter a year, I could pay for your EP. I'd have saved just a dime a year. So he had worked it out, whatever it was, 15 cents, you know, whatever it was. It kind of cracked me up. But yeah, it took a little while. But I know why that is. And there are two reasons. Number one, I'm an incurable perfectionist, which I think goes along with being an editor. But also, I had this, I won't say fixation, but I had this inclination that I had to do everything myself. And I just never got things finished when I was trying to be the composer and the musician and the recording engineer and the mastering engineer and the blah and the arranger and blah, 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 blah. It just never happened. So that was one aspect of why it never happened. The other aspect was I was always trying to do a full album. I wanted to have 12 songs or more songs or whatever. And I have a more than full-time gig, and I do, you know, writing on the side, and I write books, and, you know, I do lots of other stuff. And I have a family, you know, I have a wife, and like to do things with her now and then. And, you know, there's lots of other things, right?
Yeah.
And so it was just too big of a project to ever finish. So when I talked to, again, a bunch of artists, they were all saying, you know, we're not doing albums anymore. We're doing EPs. We're doing four or five songs at a time, or we're releasing a song a month and then releasing an EP. And we're getting multiple touches per year with our fans. And they love it because they get four songs and they get four songs and they get four songs. And plus, it's really easy. We can just do four songs instead of having to have 12, or, you know. And so, you know, I'm not completely stupid. I said, you know, maybe that'll work for me. and so that was the key, was deciding that what I was going to do was five songs, and I was not going to do it all myself. And part of what made that happen was we had a guitar player named Tom Hemby, who's an incredible session player from Nashville, who also does solo albums, fusion style guitars and jazz albums. And he was coming in to record, and I had met some of the musicians in his band before interviewed some of them before, and Sidus reached out through the studio. They didn't know it was me necessarily, but just reached out to them and said, "Hey, will you guys come in early and play on some tracks?" So they said, "We have one day. We'll come in one day." So I had this was like 3 weeks in advance. So I'm sitting there now. I got to come up with five songs and charts and, you know, the whole kind of thing. So necessity is the deadline. It's not the mother of invention. It's a deadline, you know. So it was like, if I didn't get that done, we weren't recording it. But I had paid for the musicians and I had paid for the session time. So I was able to get Keith Carlock, who's the drummer for Steely Dan and Toto, like, you know, incredible drummer, and Adam Nitti and Michael Whitaker, again, guys with just these incredible credentials who were playing in Tom's band. And the four of us went in the day before their scheduled session and were able to do five songs, the basic tracks for five songs, in one day out of it, which, again, it was recording live just in the studio. And I call this the Opportunity EP because that was just an opportunity I couldn't pass up to have those guys. And I had a similar opportunity later, Carl Verheyen, who's just an absolutely astounding LA session guitar player. He's played with Supertramp for 30 or 40 years or something. Just and also a really good friend and a really great guy, was going to be here for a couple of hours. And so I snagged 2 hours with him in the studio to lay down some parts on as a guest. And I had a chance to piggyback onto a horn section session down in Nashville at Ocean Way. And I just couldn't pass it up. I was like, okay, well, these guys are going in there. How about if I just, you know, take a couple hours at the end? And so, you know, we did all the horn charts, and like the guys played them down in like an hour and a half. And then the saxophone player stayed for an hour and played a couple solos and melodies, and hey, we're done, you know. And then the work was just mine to record my parts at home and to clean stuff up and mix it. But it's a very organic approach, even though we did do some separate sessions there and I did lay the guitars on later. It was still, I wanted that organic band playing in a room kind of thing with the rhythm section. You know, there's no editing to a grid. There were, I think we punched in maybe two or three notes on it on the basic tracks, and everything is, there was no more than two takes on eight per song. So it was either the first take or the second take, and it was a complete take, and that's what we used. And I just loved that about it because it took me totally out of that perfectionist, you know, mindset of oh, I'm going to grid everything and I'm going to fix everything and I'm going to, but there was nothing to fix because with Keith Carlock drumming, what are you going to fix? The guy's perfect. Yeah. You know? It's already perfect. You know, why would I mess with that? And why would I mess with Adam Nitti playing bass or Michael Whitaker's organ playing or you know, EP electric piano playing. So that was the approach that worked. And I now think I've got it figured out and I want to do more things. Now I'm very excited about the way the whole thing came together because it was so much fun letting other people do what they do. So Mark Hornsby, who's he runs the studios here, did the engineering for the basic tracks and also for the horn section. I went out to have it mastered in New York. Scott Hall mastered it for me out there, who coincidentally also did some of the Steely Dan stuff that Keith Carlock played on. And John Hinchy did the horn charts for me. So I was able to sit back and say, you know, let these people who do these things do them better than I can do them. Just because I can do them doesn't mean I should. And the product's going to be better. The end result is going to be better if I let them do it. And I just kind of produce and compose and, you know, play a few guitar licks here and there. And so I'm very pleased with the way it came out.
That's awesome, Mitch. And really, that's the best way to do it when it's all said and done. If you get great players, you just let them do their thing and it usually comes out pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had people ask me, can I see the charts? What did you give the? They were curious, you know, what did I give the keyboard player? What did I give the drummer? What did I give the bass player? And they're just lead sheets, you know. It's just chord charts, and their parts are what they put. You know, am I really going to tell Michael Whitaker what to play on keyboards? You know, I'm not going to. You know, there's no reason for me to do that when he's so brilliant at just coming up with things. And as were all the musicians on there, you know, if anything, like someone with Carl Verheyen, there's too many ideas. He's such an idea engine. That you have this, you know, this huge mass of things at the end where you go, well, okay, let's take this. But I really tried to keep it to, I'm taking complete takes, you know, so he would do three takes of a solo and just pick the best one.
Or
the one you like the best, because they're all great. And any one of them would have been perfectly fine. And that translated to mixing it too. I tried to mix it like a band. I did mix it myself. I toyed with the idea of sending it off and having someone mix it. I know so many engineers and producers in the industry, and I did even talk to a couple of people about mixing it just to, again, remove myself from that process. But I had such a specific idea of what I wanted it to sound like, and You know, there's almost no processing on the record. There's very, very little compression, very, very little EQ. What you're hearing is 80% what we captured in the studio. And even though, again, there were a couple different sessions and all I did was try to make them sound like they were all in the same room. When we mastered it, there was no concern with making it loud. I told Scott, what I want to hear are the dynamics that the musicians played. And I don't want a really bright kind of sound, which I know a lot of people really like. I don't want a lot of bottom end. I want it to sound like musicians in a room playing. And it's been gratifying that without me telling people that, that's what I've been hearing back, that it sounds like a band playing in a room. And so that's very gratifying to me.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of gear did you use and guitar gear? What was your setup?
It may surprise people, but I actually recorded the guitars. 90% of the guitars are recorded direct. So Carl's guitars, it was a deluxe that Mark Hornsby and I modded. I changed out some tubes and changed some things around and speakers and cabinets and things. His was mic'd, and I think one of my tracks that I took in and reamped survived. But everything else I did at home with I recorded direct into an Apollo, the second generation Apollo 8P or Apollo 8. With a Rupert Neve, an R&DI direct box. So I recorded direct into Pro Tools, monitoring through my amp at the same time. And then everything was reamped back out through either a Fuchs Overdrive Supreme, a Friedman Bucks and Betty, or I have two Fender Deluxes that Paul Rivera modded for me. Basically, he did the same mod on those that the 70s studio players were using. So Paul Jackson Jr. and Lee Ritenour and Larry Carlton, all those guys had these Rivera modded amps. I've got the same thing. I've got a pair of those. So it was reamped back out through one of those three amps and then recorded into a little box called a Rivera Mini Rock Rec. And that is a load box and also an analog speaker emulator. So it's got a switch on it. You can choose six different speaker cabinets and it's just a filter network in there. Works great for me. And that went straight into a Neve, a Shelford channel, which I did not use the EQ, didn't really use the compression, just used basically the preamp section of that, into a Burl A to D converter, and then digitally into the Apollo. And I'm just so thrilled with the way that came out. And no one has been able to tell me which track was mic'd and which track was direct. So again, I'm gratified by that. To me, they sound totally natural, and I've never had anybody say, oh, those guitars sound direct, but there was no speakers were harmed in the making of this record.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Yeah. Well, there you go. There's a trend for you.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. So I did it all by my little bedroom studio at home is where the guitars were all done.
Very cool, Mitch. Well, congrats for getting it finished. That's terrific. Getting it out and doing such a great job.
Thank you. Yeah.
Last question for you, Mitch. You've been in the business for a long time, and when I say the business, I mean the business. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe someone imparted to you or maybe you learned along the way?
Boy, that's a great question. I remember very early on when I first came to Sweetwater, we would have these little sales meetings, and there were only a few of us at the time, and Chuck was actually selling on the phone at the time. He was a full-time sales guy in addition to running the company, and so there were it was Chuck and five of us, or six of us maybe by that point. And I remember we were looking at a product, and it was a low-end product. And at the time, we were much more focused on high-end and high technology and kinds of things. And so I think maybe it was apparent that none of us were very impressed with it. And Chuck stopped us, and he said, you know, there is a right application and a right person for every product. And so you have to remove your personal prejudices and opinions and try to be as objective as you can, because you're doing a disservice to the person who this product is right for by assuming that it's not appropriate for anybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe not up to your highly, you know, arrogant standards, maybe would be the way that I would probably put it. I always kept that in mind. That really had an impact on me. I did sales for just a couple of years there, but I think it impacted me even more when I started getting into gear coverage and also music coverage, in that, you know, as a journalist and as someone who's presenting this to the public and trying to really, I view myself as much as anything as an educator in what I do, that you really have to keep, you really need to have an open mind and be looking for what something is appropriate for and where it fits in the grand scheme of things. Because it's really true. There are very few products that just are not right and they don't last long. I mean, they're kind of, it's usually pretty obvious that they just, there's something wrong or whatever.
Yeah.
But regardless of price range, regardless of technology, regardless of manufacturer, regardless of anything else, you really have to look at each product as its own kind of thing, and each type of music as its own kind of thing, and each musician as their own kind of, you know, on and on and on down the line, each engineer, because they're all contributing something. If they're doing it, they're contributing something that works for somebody. And so I view my job as finding that aspect of it. You know, you asked me earlier about, you know, what's the cool gear and, you know, all those kind of, you know, and I talked a little bit about how cool it is to see things. And I think people would be very interested to know that a lot of the stuff that's in my office and that's around is not the mega dollar stuff. I certainly love that stuff. But there is so much that can be done and so much that is right about affordable gear. And I think that is obvious because of the home studio thing. But all of my opinion on all of that stems from that very early conversation with Chuck back in the day. You know, that would have been back probably 92 or so when he said that to me, to all of us. And I've carried it on ever since then. On the musical side, it was Carl Verheyen. I was bemoaning how long my EP was taking because it actually took me 2 years to put it out. And I was kind of whining. And basically he said, just put it out. This is a document of where you are at this moment. And if you never get it out, you'll never have that document. And you'll never be able to move on to the next one and you'll never be able to progress. So just finish it, put it out and move on to the next thing. And that really was a big piece of advice that allowed me to move on. And it's interesting. I've never had that problem with articles or with books. I can write the book and it's done, or I can write the article and it's done. For some reason with the music, the perfectionist thing kicks in and it's less easy to do that. So those are the two pieces of advice that really have come together for me.
How many books have you written?
I believe seven. I'd have to count seven or eight.
Yeah. What was the last one?
The last one was the Guitar Tone. It was called Guitar Tone. And it was my goal with it was to provide kind of the ultimate encyclopedia of the everything in the signal path that goes into creating a guitar tone. Yeah. So everything from the strings to the cables to the picks to the pickups to the woods to the frets to the speakers to the pedals to the tubes to, you know, the first half of the book is delving into all those aspects and exploring as deeply as possible. The second half of the book, I took, I think it's 13 players 11 or 13 players and dissected their rigs and their players who are well known for their tone. And looked back through and tried to give readers an idea of what modern gear would allow them to achieve what these players were getting, you know, through the years or with vintage kind of equipment. So that was the last one that that came out.
That's great. I did one very similar, maybe 10 years ago, the Ultimate Guitar Tone Handbook, and it looked at much the same thing. And then the second half was all interviews, not necessarily with guitar players, although there were several, but with some manufacturers as well. Someone at D'Addario and Dick Boak at Martin and some people like that. So it was cool. And I must admit, the reason why I write books is I want to learn something. And I learned a lot, you know, with that one.
Yeah.
So it was really good. But
exactly. I learned far more. You know, it's just like teaching a class. I've taught quite a bit adjunct at there's a branch of Indiana and Purdue University here. It actually they've now split to where it's Purdue, and Purdue now has the music program. And in fact, we have a studio program here on Sweetwater campus for Purdue University. But I did a lot of adjunct teaching in their recording program and also their music business program. And I always learned far more teaching the classes or writing the books or writing the articles than I was ever able to impart, you know, even in a good sized book.
Yeah. You can find out more about Mitch at MitchGallagher.com. That's all one word. Mitch, MITCH, Gallagher, GALLAGHER, MitchGallagher.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, and Google Podcasts. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts to new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.